Evening. Sorry that we're starting a little bit late. So we're jumping to the next lesson, which is Christianity and the politics of Imperial Rome, 4th century, and really what starts here continues in some places for the next 1,000 years. I was telling somebody else today that this class is about 25 to 30 lectures, and we're already on like 12 or 13, and you might be thinking we're still in the 300s. Understand this, it takes probably 60 to 70% of the time just to get to 500. And then once we're at 500, we get from 500 to 1500 really fast because not a lot changes. I mean, there's change, but the biggest change, the most rapid stuff is in the period we're talking about. And so if you notice, we spent a lot of time going from about the year 100 to 325. A lot of different things: internal pressure, external pressure, doctrine, snapshots, all that kind of stuff. And then we get to 325. Now, what I want to do is hit the politics that come as a result of the legalization of Christianity. So that's really what we're going to be focusing on. And my goal is to take us up through about 400, because what's in place there, we don't really have to talk too much about political changes until we get to the fall of Rome, and then the rise of Islam after that. And so a lot of this stuff's going to be pretty stable. So this lesson focuses on the intersection of Christianity and politics immediately following its legalization, the conversion of Constantine, and his life dates as 274 to 337. This is the single most historically significant conversion to Christianity other than the Apostle Paul. And I know some people are going to be like, well, Constantine was no Paul. Yes, what I'm talking about is historical impact. Constantine's conversion, I mean, it changes history. It sets the path of how European history and even Asian history, not like Far Asia, but meaning like Asia Minor, like Turkey and all that. It's going to set the course for that history for some time to come. I mean, things that Constantine does are going to affect what happens in Russia. So, I mean, a very important conversion. It definitely leads to a lot of, it just, it left a big legacy. It defined what Christianity would look like in Western societies until the 20th century. And that's no exaggeration. And the same is true of some Eastern societies, not all of them, but some, like the Russian Orthodox Church. After Constantine, the relationship between church and state continued to morph until Christianity was Rome's official religion. And I know I'm going to say this again somewhere in the midst of this lesson, but Constantine did not make Rome Christian. There's no way. Okay, but he started the course of that. And by the time you get to Theodosius, around 380, he will be able to make Rome officially Christian. All Constantine does is tolerate it and make it legal. But that doesn't make the empire Christian. So you hear a lot of these conspiracy theories, well, Constantine made the empire Christian and then they stamped out all the false Christianity. No, that is just Dan Brown writing books to make money, and so Hollywood can make movies. There's zero evidence for that. So anyhow, even after, though, Christianity becomes Rome's official religion, how state and church relate to each other is going to differ from east to west. And I'll throw some terms around for you when we get there, because the east will be defined by something called Caesaropapism, or Caesaropapism, depending on how you pronounce it, and then the west will be, for a while, separation of church and state will define it, but then eventually it'll turn to theocracy, but not in the era that we're talking about. So anyhow, a little bit about Constantine's conversion. Some of this is review from the persecution lesson. I just know it's been a lot of lessons since then. So this man was a tremendous force and factor of change for the church. You know, think about it. Every emperor before this, in some form, probably persecuted the church. None of them were proponents of the church that actually helped the church. I've already given his life dates. Constantine claims to be a Christian. Now, this wasn't out of the blue. His mother, Helena, was a Christian, but his father, Constantius, was a pagan, a worshiper of Sol Invictus. But he tolerated Christians because he understood it did him no good to be hunting them down. I don't know if you guys remember, but Rome hit a huge state of chaos. By the time you get to the 270s, you have a lot of emperors being killed and then replaced by another emperor who gets killed. It looked like the empire was going to fall apart. Then you get a brilliant administrator named Diocletian, and the way that he saved it is he divided the empire in half between east and west. And so you have an eastern Augustus and a western Augustus, and then they each had a deputy that helped them that was called a Caesar, an eastern Caesar and a western Caesar. And the way it ended up working then is you technically had four rulers of the empire, although two were superior to the other two. Constantius was one of those four, okay? And he was over Britannia, which I'm sure you could figure out I'm talking about Switzerland. No, I'm talking about England, Britannia, right? And Gaul, which is modern-day France. And if you're having to govern all this area, he realized it does not help to persecute a minority religion, so he left them alone. And he left them alone enough to where he married one of them, okay? And so it probably, he didn't want to sleep on the couch. So You know, the way marriages were back then, I don't think a wife would make the general sleep on the couch. But the point is, he had a tolerant posture towards Christians. Constantine grew up with that. Although at first he had his dad's religion. He worshipped Sol Invictus. But he knew a little bit about Christianity. Now, he was illegitimately born, but eventually he does become the heir and inherits, pretty much his parents' titles and so forth. And he also learned to be a talented general and able politician. I'm going to talk a little bit about his political skill. He was really good at what he does, and that's why he's going to be the one who's able to bring Rome back under a single ruler after Diocletian set all that stuff up. Now, by way of reminder, in 312, he decides he wants to be the sole ruler of Rome. So first he has to defeat the other guy in the west, which was Maxentius. Maxentius controlled Italy, Alps, those parts, I would assume, Egypt. And so pretty much he has to conquer Rome. And he does. Now, there's going to be a battle at the Milvian Bridge. He was outnumbered. He only brought a quarter of his troops with them. And the long story short is he claimed that the day before the battle, he looked up to the sky and he saw a vision of a chi and a rho superimposed upon each other. A chi is, it looks like an X in Greek. It's the K sound for Christ. And then the rho, it looks like a P, but it's the R sound. These are the first two letters of Christ. And Christians at this time put the two together as a symbol because the chi looks like a cross and the rho looks like a person on the cross. And they thought this is a perfect symbol to represent Christianity. Constantine says he saw this symbol and said, in this sign, you will conquer. So he immediately had the symbol painted on all of his soldiers' shields, and then he goes into this big battle. He wins. His enemy gets killed. He's now the sole ruler of the West, and he credits the Christian God. He says it had to be the Christian God. I was not a worshiper of that God, but that God showed me this symbol, and I did conquer in the name of that God. So that's Constantine's basic conversion story. And then, he has to get control of the rest of the empire. And again, he's good at what he does. He was a political genius. Even before he would conquer his enemies, he would strategically plan it for years. He didn't just go after you. What he would do is he would take sometimes a decade. He would wait. So for example, before he took out Maxentius, when he was in control of Gaul and Britannia, he would defeat the barbarians. Very few other Roman generals were able to defeat the German barbarians. He did. He kept them at bay. Then he would tax his people high, but not so high that they lose their loyalty. He knew exactly how far he could push them and keep them loyal because of what he was able to provide for them, the protection. Now, once he had the West loyal to him and really no enemies within his part of the empire, he started making his plans. And then he gets the whole of the West, Rome, and now he's making his plans for the East. Now, the guy he has to overthrow is Licinius. He's the Augustus of the East. So Constantine, rather than just going straight to war with them, says, hey, why don't you marry my sister? Then we'll be on the same side. Again, a shrewd politician. At the same time Licinius takes his sister as a wife, Constantine is planning for war. Yet all the moves he makes are calculated to where when the war finally does start, it looks like Licinius was the aggressor rather than Constantine. Again, only a special kind of tactician can successfully pull this off. And there's a lot more history I could say, but this is not a a history of Rome class. This is a history of the church. So I'm moving through this fast. There was a series of wars. Each one, Constantine won a little more of Licinius's land than they had worked something out. And then Constantine, a few years later, would push further. And so, and not only that, there were more Christians in the East. And when they found out Constantine was claiming to be a Christian, they started praying for him. And the interesting thing was Licinius, actually, even though he wasn't a Christian, he believed there was power in the Christian God. And so he even told his soldiers, if we fight Constantine, do not look at their shields, because if you look at that symbol, you're going to lose. It's kind of weird. So Constantine was already in this guy's head to the point where he was going to win. You know, he won before the battles even started. So there's going to be a series of wars. Constantine wins. And then he says, Licinius, if you just surrender and abdicate and I become the sole ruler, listen, you can live in peace for the rest of your days. I mean, you're my brother-in-law. You're married to my sister. So just abdicate, man. And he does. And so he's now the sole ruler. Then a few years later, Licinius still gets murdered on charges of conspiracy. Now, some people say, Constantine, what a shrewd jerk. Others say, well, what if he really conspired? I mean, because he did hate Constantine for, you know, taking his half of the empire from him. I don't think we'll ever know. I mean, the Christian sources from the time are favorable to Constantine, so they'll make it sound like there really was a conspiracy. Skeptical historians today would say, well, they had a vested interest to believe Constantine, so who knows? All we could say is Constantine won, and eventually he had his rival killed, for whatever reason. Now, you hear all this, and you're like, Constantine was a politically shrewd individual. And because of that, some people say this calls his Christianity into question, meaning, was he really a Christian? A lot of people think, nope, this was all fake. It was an act. This was just one more part of his shrewdness to get power. We'll talk about that a little later. Because I think we have to evaluate Constantine by the standards of that time rather than what we might want to think today. And so I'll try my best with that. But a little more about him, right? It's important to recognize that he simply legalized and privileged Christianity, but he did not make the Roman Empire Christian. It would have been impossible. Paganism was still going to be a legal religion because the majority of the people were pagan. Okay, it's not that the majority of the population were Christian. That first map, you weren't able to see it because this light bulb isn't very good. But on the first slide I had, there was a map of the empire, and it showed how many places were thoroughly Christian by the year 300. They were little pockets. The majority of the empire was still pagan. And because of that, he had to be the emperor for both Christians and pagans. He couldn't just be the emperor for Christians. Right? So he's not going to make the Roman Empire Christian, but he does legalize it. Now, Rome was in decline, so he had this desire to restore its grandeur, whereas the past emperors thought we could only do this by honoring the old gods. Constantine said, no, I think we need to honor the God that put me in charge, and that's the Christian God. And so he's going to do a lot of things that favor Christianity, and he's going to reshape the empire really in the name of that Christian God, even if he doesn't understand that God very well. Now, he's going to get pushback. The Senate in Rome, that venerable Senate, which was the head of that old aristocracy, they opposed all this. They didn't like Christianity. They were old school pagans, and their families went back to the pagan foundations of Rome. What is this guy doing? And so because of their opposition, Constantine's going to realize it's going to be better if he leaves Rome and moves the center of the empire to the east. And if you know a little bit of history, you know where I'm going with this. He builds one of the greatest cities in the world, Constantinople. Now, at first, it was a smaller city called Byzantium, which, you know, only had about, it was only, it, here's how big it was. Its wall that surrounded it was only 2 miles, which isn't that big for a major city back then. And so he's going to go and have this thing expanded. I can't tell you exactly how big because I don't know, but it was huge and they could fit multitudes there when it was done. So his plan is to build up Constantinople. He's going to have two magnificent churches built there, no pagan temples. He'll allow pagan statues there. He'll even allow some vestiges of pagan worship, but no pagan temples. Only churches could be built there. And there was no gladiatorial arenas allowed because he wanted to make gladiatorial combat illegal. He's like, this is just evil. Again, that's what the Christians were saying. Nobody else was saying that at the time. Maybe some Stoics were. But for the most part, that was a Christian position. And he adopted that position. But, man, Romans loved that violent sport. And so although he was able to get rid of the arena in some areas, he couldn't get rid of it everywhere in his lifetime. But he made sure it was not going to be a part of Constantinople like it was such a big part of Rome. Now, as he's building Constantinople, pagans were allowed in the process. So as he's going around doing these ceremonies and these rituals, he has Christian bishops with him, but he also has pagan priests as well. So again, some people will be like, oh, he's compromised. Yeah, perhaps. But also the majority of his empire is pagan and he's ruler of both and he's not trying to start a religious war. He's simply stopping the Christian persecution and favoring Christianity now. Now, some people will be like, yeah, but he brought the most famous statue of Apollo all the way from Egypt and put it in Constantinople and put it on a pedestal that made it 125 feet tall, which he did. And it was a beautiful sculpture, but he beheaded it and then had somebody make a sculpture of his face and he put his face on top of it. So he wasn't claiming to be Apollo. He was just claiming that it's not Apollo that the city's named after. It's me. And what's the city called? Constantinople. Okay, so yeah, does that mean he had an ego? They all did. All those emperors did. Now, one thing the rest of the Roman Empire hated was that he plundered the rest of its major cities to fill Constantinople with luxury items. One cool thing when we went to Israel is we learned a lot about how expensive marble was. And during this time, if you could get marble, great. But most of the time you couldn't anymore. So if something new was being built, you stole all the marble from other places and brought it to the new place. And so they were telling us, like, there's various sites in Israel where you could tell, like, this has marble, but then there's a lot of marble missing. Like, it was sent to Constantinople. So not that anybody cares except for me, but I thought it was interesting, you know, and I was touching some of the marble being like, ah, oh, the brother piece of this is in Istanbul right now. But anyhow, that's what nerds do. Moving east, when he left, when he left Rome and goes to the east, and by the way, Constantinople is right on the Bosphorus, so it's at the very edge of I guess you could say the Greek lands, and right across the sea is going to be Asia Minor. It really is a perfect location, but it leaves the West vulnerable, because if the seat of power is now way on the edge of Eastern Europe, then the seat of power is no longer in Rome. All the focus, military, all that stuff's going to be focused there. And you got these barbarian invasions that keep happening. It's no surprise that in the next century, the Western Empire gets conquered, but the Eastern Empire is fine. I don't know if you realize this. We always say Rome fell in 479. The Western part fell in 479. The Eastern Empire lasted until the 1400s. I don't know if you realize that. It lasted a lot longer. And they still called themselves Romans. So just something to keep in mind there. It was either the 1300s or 1400s. But anyhow, so this does have consequences for the future. Now, talking a little bit about the man's faith, the idea, some people say, look, he's not sincere. He was a shrewd politician. And they'll cite some distinctly unchristian behavior in the later part of his life. For example, he did have people executed for political reasons. Like the typical Roman emperor, life was cheap to those who were his enemies. He didn't care if he killed them. And some people on his hit list was his father-in-law, three of his brother-in-laws. My goodness, you marry this man, your dad and your brothers are going to die. And then one of his wives. So you marry this guy, you're going to die. Now, of course, it was always on charges of conspiracy. And there's the possibility that some of these people did conspire. But at the same time, there's also evidence that he was just hot-tempered and he believed reports without verifying them, because he even executed his firstborn son, Crispus, because his wife, not Crispus's wife, but Constantine's wife, who was Crispus's stepmother, accused Crispus of trying to sexually assault her. And rather than hear his son's side, he was so mad just hearing this from his wife, he had his son executed. Now, later, early Christian writers will say he repented of that. He realized it was wrong and he did it off of his temper. But that does give you maybe a window into his temperament, and maybe the same kind of thing happened with some of these other executions. Maybe somebody simply had to say, hey, this person's conspiring against you. And he's like, all right, kill him now. You know, and then maybe later he finds out it wasn't true. Now, another problem with him, another reason people will say we should doubt any type of salvation in him, would be because in the later part of his life, he sided with the Arians. Okay, so you have the Council of Nicaea, which firmly says Trinitarianism's true. Arius gets exiled. But then Constantine has a friend named Eusebius of Nicomedia, who was sympathetic to Arianism and convinced him of the Arianism more and more. So by the time Constantine died, it did seem he was more prone to favor the Arians, and his son, who takes over after him, flat out declares the empire Arian and starts persecuting Orthodox Christians. So you do have that. That is a valid concern about Constantine. But what I would say, if we're going to be fair, is even though the Council of Nicaea was done, Constantinople hadn't happened yet. The Council of Constantinople and the Council of Chalcedon hadn't happened. And so there were still confusion over this. And there were some Orthodox believers accusing other Orthodox believers of being heretics, even when both sides believed in the deity of Christ. There was confusion over the words, like what's meant by homoousios versus homoiousios. And I'll be talking about that when we get to the Council of Nicaea. There's eventually going to come a point where the people who said they believed in homoiousios actually meant what their opponents meant when they said homoousios. And so like 80 years later, they're like, wait, you mean to say we believed the same thing the whole time? We were just confused over what this word meant? Yes. And so when you see that confusion that was there, you know, you can give Constantine a little bit of a break on this, because everybody was confused. I would say after the Council of Chalcedon, nobody's got any excuse, okay? But up until that point, and that's going to be in the next century, but up until that point, there was a lot of confusion even among the Orthodox. I think it's fair to say that Constantine was just a complicated individual. He legalized and he favored Christianity, yet he never put himself under the church. He put himself above the church. He called himself the equal to the apostles, and he declared himself to be the bishop of bishops, right? And so the church couldn't tell him what to do, but he thought he could tell the church what to do. And so right away he sees, oh, there's a dispute between Arians and Trinitarians. And so I summon a council, and the bishop showed up and they obeyed, like, okay, we're gonna figure this out. And they did, and it was Trinitarianism. But that gives you a little bit of a window again into Constantine's mind on this, of that he's not under the church, he's above the church, but at the same time, he still took part in pagan rituals. And so you'd be like, really? Like, what's going on with that? And the church never challenged him on it. Now, you might think that's because they're a bunch of cowards. Well, I think you're going to see with another emperor, one that had just as strong of a will as Constantine, you're going to see the church challenge him and put him in his place more than once. The stated reason why the church didn't try to put Constantine in his place is he was not baptized. And remember, in the theology of that time, you are not technically a Christian until you're baptized. So you're not going to be excommunicated or church disciplined until you're baptized. So they said, listen, he says he believes in Christ, and we believe he believes in Christ, but he's not a Christian. He has not united himself with Christ in baptism. He's still in his sin. If he dies, he's going to go to hell. So that's how they saw him. They're like, so you don't force non-believers to live like believers. Instead, they saw him as one who was friendly to the faith, but not fully of the faith, at least not yet. But they had hope that he would be, because the older he got, the more Christian he got. Okay, so a lot of times when people bring these things up, I ask, okay, when he did X, Y, and Z ritual, was this early in his reign or later in his reign? Because later in his reign, you find a lot less of that. Okay, because he technically becomes more and more devoted to Christian doctrine. But throughout his whole reign, no. So the church said, look, he's not a Christian. He could receive the advice and support of the church, but we can't direct him. And again, Constantine becomes a believer, or he gets baptized, shall I say, only upon his deathbed. And does anybody remember why people would wait till their deathbed? It's because they believe that sins are only forgiven up to baptism. You commit any sins after baptism, you might be in trouble. So Constantine's like, fine, I'll wait until I can't sin anymore. Well, I got news for him. We can sin in our mind. You can sin when you're in a coma. Just understand that. We don't need help. So anyhow, a little bit more about his faith. So I gave you some of the bad with him, and I'll give you, I think I have some more bad elsewhere, but let's talk about some of the good. He regularly attended Christian worship services, like he was there every Sunday. He listened to some of the longest sermons, like the longest-winded preachers. He would have been fine with how long I go when I preach. He had no problem. He would listen to long sermons. He celebrated Easter with reverence. He did not celebrate the pagan celebrations with reverence. And then the older he got, he would give public speeches against paganism and idolatry and say how they're just not true and Christianity is the true faith. Even unbaptized, he would give speeches like that. When his audience would clap and cheer him during his speeches, he would say, stop. And he'd point to heaven and say, no, clap for God. You know, so there's certain things about him where you're like, okay, he killed his son, but then he's doing this. He's a mixed bag. He's a complicated individual. What can I say? When he conquered Rome, what every other conqueror does is they thank the gods. He didn't. He only gave credit and only celebrated the Christian God. He legally made Sunday the day of worship and day of rest for Christians. Couldn't make Christians work on Sunday. He constructed church buildings at his own expense, not the government's expense, out of his own wealth. You remember, churches were worshiping in houses. Now he's like, no, you guys are going to get your own buildings, and I'm going to pay to build some of these. And then he would fund his mother's expeditions where she would go to Jerusalem. And man, there's so much stuff in Jerusalem that was built by Constantine's mom. Helena, he's going to fund all that. Now that's going to feed into relics and the veneration of saints more, but I digress. He even gifted to the Bishop of Rome the ancient palace of the Laterani family. Now the Laterani family was one of the wealthiest, most powerful pagan families in Rome. Their palace was given to the Bishop of Rome, which then becomes the palace of later popes. What is the Pope's palace called today? The Lateran Cathedral. It's named after that Laterani family. So next time you're on Jeopardy or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you've got a chance. He even made Christian bishops part of the legal system in civil cases. So let's say you wanted to sue somebody, but you didn't want to go to a secular court. You could actually go to the local bishop. And Constantine said, whatever the bishop says in that case actually has the force of law as if a secular judge said it. So you did have a mingling of church and state, and bishops did get some civil power. Constantine also, at the advice of the church, passed welfare laws for the poor. The church thought, look, if we can give money to the poor, it will probably make it to where less people will murder their babies because they don't want them. And it worked. It did help. And so you had that. He forbid or outlawed crucifixion. Romans were no longer going to kill people with crucifixion after Constantine. He's the one who stopped it. And I mentioned he tried to end gladiatorial games, but didn't have full success. But here's the thing. Remember, paganism was still legal, okay? But he passed laws that said you cannot practice witchcraft and you can't do private sacrifices. Pagan sacrifices can now only happen in the public sphere. You can't be a private pagan anymore. So you could see, like, the move was away from that and it was toward Christianity. Constantine truly believed, it seems like when you read everything that he left behind for us, that he genuinely believed that he owed his position as emperor to the Christian God. Just like past emperors thought, well, I owe it to Jupiter, or I owe it to Sol Invictus, so I'm going to build temples for him everywhere. Constantine had the same mentality, but towards the Christian God. So he's like, I have to advance this God's cause, because this is the one that put me in power. Now, some people believe that he simply converted to Christianity for political expediency, that he thought it would help him get control of the empire. But it is very hard, evidentially speaking, to make that argument. And here's why. It would have gained him no benefit. It really wouldn't have. Christians were the poorest people of the society. He was not going to be able to get any wealth or support from them. There was no economic benefit. Christians were still a minority. There were more pagans. In fact, you have an easier time getting support if you go after a hated minority. That's what previous emperors did. Nobody was going to pat him on the back other than Christians who were a minority for doing this. And in fact, the ruling classes, the richest people of the empire, and the people who held almost all the political positions, including the esteemed venerable Senate, they were pagan. They were pagan in the army, okay? If you're in power, you depend on the army. The army, the biggest form of worship in the army was the cult of Mithras. The soldiers loved the cult of Mithras for some reason. And those who weren't part of the cult of Mithras, they weren't Christians. In fact, there was a Christian legion under Diocletian's reign, and he wiped them out during the persecution. So pretty much, it's not like he's going to have more soldier support by becoming a Christian. So he doesn't get money. He doesn't get political favor for this. And he doesn't get any kudos from the military. There's literally nothing he has to gain at this point in time for claiming to be a Christian. When he waged war to get control of Rome at the Milvian Bridge, his enemy was supported by the power brokers in Rome because his enemy was a pagan. Okay, they did not want Constantine to win. Now, once he won, what could they do? But they weren't happy about it, and that's why he builds Constantinople. Fine, I'll move the seat of my power elsewhere. So my point is, all of becoming a Christian would cause more problems for him, not less. And so when you take it all together, it's likely that, not likely, it's a matter of fact that he believed that the Christian God was real and powerful, and he believed that all of his victories came from the God of his mother, the God of Helena, the Christian God. And so what he did is he enacted laws in favor of Christianity, and he built churches for them. And some people will be like, so he was trying to get their goodwill. No, because again, they had no power. He was trying to get the goodwill of their God. If I take care of them, then their God will take care of me. And again, to even do that and think that way means he believes in that God. So he has faith. Now, is it saving faith? That's what people debate, but it's faith. And this is not political expediency. This is a man who really believed this. Okay? Now, that's why I say when you take the balance of the evidence, his faith appears to be sincere. But his understanding of the Christian message was novice at best, and that is why he still would serve pagan gods, for the sake of the government and think, well, it's not that big of a deal, especially since I don't believe in them. I'm just doing these rituals, and so on his early coins, he put the Christian God, but the names of a lot of the other Roman gods and said, look, I'm making everybody happy, So yeah, it was a very novice faith. His father, as I mentioned, followed Sol Invictus, the victorious or unconquerable son. And some historians argue that Constantine thought they were the same god, because the cult of Sol Invictus believed that he was the supreme deity over all other deities, that he's the creator of all the rest. And it's similar to what Christians would claim, though not identical. So some people say, well, Constantine probably thought they were the same. And Sol, right? Sun, S-U-N, what do we call the first day of the week? Sunday. It's actually named after Sol Invictus. Now, Christians would call it the Lord's Day. When he declares Sunday to be the official day of worship, all the people who follow Sol Invictus are like, great, And all the Christians are like, great. And so some people look at that and think that he had a type of syncretic blend between the two. And who knows? It's hard to say. I just know later and later in his life, it was more and more Christian, everything that he was saying. And remember, when Constantine became the emperor, an emperor could not undo paganism. It was the majority in the government, the army, the academies, and he had to rule the whole society. And that's why, and I mentioned like early in his reign, you got coins like this that have the names of the gods as well as Christian symbols on them. But eventually he's going to start to mature in his faith. In fact, that's what this next slide tells us. As the years progressed, his faith developed as well. He started leaving behind the ancient pagan religion as he gained a better understanding of Christian doctrine. After he defeated Licinius, he gave the edict in 324 that all soldiers have to worship God on Sunday. But again, some people will say, yeah, that's nothing because of Sol Invictus. I don't know. I think it was something when I look at it, especially as his faith was maturing. And he did start appointing Christians to the government against the will of the pagan Senate in Rome. They didn't want that. He's like, nope, I'm going to start putting Christians in more positions of power. In the course of time, you guys are going to be cycled out, and it's going to be Christians that are going to be ruling this society with the ethical principles of Christianity. But then that's another weird thing, right? He does that. But then the Senate, after he dies, declares him to be a god, like they declare all emperors to be gods after they die. And of course, it's not like Constantine could wake up and say, I dispute this, he was dead. But his sons seem to be okay with it. So not sure what was up with that. So I'll leave it with that when it comes to what you may or may not think about his faith. What I said is what we know, right? His impact is what I want to talk about next, and then I'm going to move to some other emperors. It goes without saying, and bless you, it goes without saying that Constantine was a complicated man and a complicated ruler, but you cannot underestimate his impact. First, persecution stopped. Second, imperial theology flourished, and I define that in the very first lesson. Okay, imperial theology was a way of looking at church history, mainly of Eusebius of Caesarea, but there were others, and they argued that Constantine was the man destined by God to bring the church and empire together as the goal of history. In other words, they didn't like the idea of separation of church and state. They thought the empire of Rome was God's gift to the world. It just lost its way with paganism. And Christianity is God's gift to the world. But for so long, these two have been separate. And so God rose Constantine as the man of the hour to bring empire and church together. And this ends up being the theology that, at least the government theology that a lot of Christians are going to hold. The one who puts the death blow on this is Augustine. Augustine's going to be like, no, because the problem is when the Roman Empire starts to collapse, people thought it was the end of the world. Like the kingdom of God is collapsing. He's like, Rome's not the kingdom of God. The city of God's the kingdom of God. Rome's just an iteration of the city of man. They're going to come and go. And then Augustinianism is going to really rule the next 1,000 years of how we understand church history. But during this time, it was the imperial theology. A third impact that comes from Constantine is as the church's favored status caused people to flock to the church grew in worldliness. And so how many of you have heard of monks and monasteries and nuns and abbots? Where did that all come from? It wasn't there in big effect prior to this. But what happens is as people realize, wait, there's social capital for being a Christian. I could get government positions. I could get tax breaks. I mean, even the people who moved to Constantinople didn't have to pay taxes, didn't have to work in the military. They got free wheat and oil. And so there's a lot of benefits for being Christian. Well, that motivates, that gives an incentive for people who aren't really Christians to become Christians. They're worldly people. Now they have influence in the church. And so you have a lot of Christians saying, this isn't right. This actually isn't a good thing. We were more pure when we were persecuted. So they want to self-persecute. separate themselves from the society, starve themselves sometimes, you know, just various things to afflict themselves so that they could focus not on this world, but on the world to come. And this is going to be a big deal for Catholicism later. Once Constantine becomes emperor, you're not going to become a martyr. You know, the government's on your side. So this was the next best thing. If you want to be an elite Christian now, you need to be a monk. Fourth impact point is that the church was now in a position to be able to finally hammer out statements of theology. When you're persecuted, you can't finish these arguments of Christology. You just can't. You're being hunted. But now that you got the government support, you've got time, you've got safety, you could assemble the bishops together, you could have councils, you could hammer out the Trinity, you could hammer out Christology, you could hammer out your pneumatology or doctrine of the Holy Spirit. You could hammer those things out. And so that's a good thing that comes from this. But remember, Constantine thought that he could, that he had the authority to intervene in orthodoxy by summoning the councils. And this is indicative of a word, it's a modern word. I think it was the 1900s, early 1900s, a historian coined this. It's called Caesaropapism. And you could kind of figure out what it means by the two words. You got Caesar and you got Pope in there. This is the idea, and it was unique to Constantine and unique to the Eastern Empire. It's the idea that the emperor has authority over the church. Okay, so the state and church are married to each other, but the state's on top. That's Caesaropapism. And the state is usually headed by a single ruler. Now listen, this is still in effect in Russia today. Vladimir Putin has authority over the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. And that's why that patriarch kisses up to him and says, this war in Ukraine is amazing. It's great. It's because of Caesaropapism. The church dare not go against the Caesar because the Caesar's above the papist part, right? He's above the patriarch. In the West, it's going to be different. It's not going to be Caesaropapism. It's going to be papism or papism. And so, again, just want to let you know, during Constantine's time, it's only Caesaropapism, but it's going to be challenged in the West, and that's what we're going to be talking about shortly. A little more on his impact. Christian worship ceased to be simple. It used to be very simple. Now it's going to be influenced by imperial protocol, like what happens in the pompous imperial world of the Roman emperors. Well, important things now happen in rich, ornate, large buildings, not crummy homes. You're now going to have burning of incense because it's got to smell good for the emperor, got to smell good for Christ. The preachers used to wear just raggedy clothes like everybody else. Now they're going to get expensive garments, you know, the vestments of the clergy. And so if you want to know, when did priests start looking like, you know, OGs and all that kind of, it's here. This is when it happens. This is when, you know, they start blinging and all that stuff. I know it's so 20 years ago. But anyhow, also they started beginning services with a processional because when the emperor would come in the room, there'd be a processional. So we got to do even greater or at least the same for Christ. In the past, everybody sang. Now a choir sings. You have riches and pomp coming to be seen as signs of divine favor, where during persecution they were looked at as you know, signs that you sold out. Now it's, hey, God's with you. So those are going to be changes that happen by merging church and state. Due to Constantine's mom, Helena, claiming to discover relics that had power in Jerusalem, like she claimed she found pieces of the true cross. When you put them all together, that's one gigantic cross. I doubt she found it. But anyhow, you get this popular folk. And she even supposedly found the nails that pierced him. And Constantine had one of them fastened to his crown. So that lets you know that these people were starting to go pretty crazy over the relics. You had a popular folk version of Christianity that becomes hard to resist, and it's an easy sell for people coming out of paganism. Instead of venerating gods, you could venerate the saints. Instead of worshiping objects that supposedly belong to the gods, now we could venerate objects that belong to the saints. Now, for what it's worth, a lot of preachers were preaching against it, but to no avail, and then eventually there will be preachers who are like, yeah, it's not so bad. Like Augustine, that'll be his position. Those pictures there were all taken by us when we were in Jerusalem. Constantine's mom believes she found exactly where Christ was crucified and buried, and so the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built on that spot. It's this this big blue basilica, and then on the inside, this is what this bottom picture is what the dome looks like from the inside. This middle picture, and I know the light bulb's not good, but online it probably looks really crisp. This little like building here, you go into it, and then you go down a little bit, and that's supposedly where he was buried, where his tomb was. And then, of course, in one of the smaller domes, this one right here, you'll find this this really very Eastern Orthodox type of Greek icon, icons. And I was going to make up a word, but it was just the icons. And it was pretty cool to look at. Now, I'll tell you, I think she was wrong. A couple hundred yards away from this, there's a much more probable site. But she claims she had divine help, and this is the spot, and therefore, even to this day, the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, they all declare this to be the spot. It's not the spot. It just isn't. Let me see, what else do I have here? Oh, and also, final point of impact, or statement of impact, is Constantine's sons. They will be the ones who cause the drift away from paganism to be far stronger. His son, Constantius, same name as his father, but that's his son's name, he took a much stronger stance against paganism, and in 356, he ordered all pagan temples to be permanently shut down. So paganism's definitely going to be on the way out. It's still going to exist for hundreds of years, and it'll even be underground for thousands of, or more than 1,000 years, even to this day. Now it's not underground anymore, but for the most part, this is when it's not a public spectacle anymore. It's the beginning of the end for it. Now, you're going to have somebody named Julian the Apostate, who's going to try to undo all this. He's the pagan's last hope, right? So let me give a little bit of background here. At the time of Constantine's death, his son Constantius takes over, and being a little paranoid, he had many relatives murdered in addition to Constantine's sons from a different mother. Constantine had more than one wife. There are multiple sons, and he had those sons killed. Now, the sons of one of those half-brothers killed was Julian and his brother, but they were boys at the time. And so he's like, yeah, they're no threat to me, so don't kill them. They would be cousins to the new emperor. Now, Constantius, I don't think he was that great of a fellow. I mean, again, he's doing stuff like this. He embraced Arianism, and he actually started persecuting real Christians. He's the one who exiled Athanasius. And so when people are like, Athanasius, the world is against you, and he's like, and I'm against the world. That dude's awesome. But anyhow, so that's all during Constantius's time. Now Julian, okay, and his brother, they were raised Christian. His brother wants to be a government official, eventually is given a political position, but then Constantius believes he's involved in a conspiracy and kills him too. So Julian is the only one left at this point, and you could kind of see how he might have an axe to grind against Constantius. And as a young man, Julian rejected Christianity, probably in his teenage years. He's like, I don't believe this. I believe the paganism. And then he started studying the pagan philosophy extensively and even started teaching it. It seemed like his goal in life was to be a pagan scholar that would focus on the pagan classics. But eventually he gets a chance to be appointed governor. He accepts it of Gaul, and he did excellent there. He was an able general, and he was an able administrator. He beat back the barbarians at a time where the barbarians were a real threat. And so because of his success, Constantius saw him as a threat and now wanted to kill him. But Julian by this point had a reputation. He was strong, and his soldiers were more loyal to him than the emperor. So they declared him to be the emperor. There was about to be a civil war, and then Constantius died. And so since Julian had a big portion of the army behind him, he had the royal blood, he was the next emperor. So 361, he is now the emperor of the Roman Empire. Now, the reason he's called Julian the Apostate is because he fell away from Christianity, and he tries to take the whole empire away from Christianity. Okay, and again, truth in advertisement, competent ruler. But again, his whole goal is, can I undo what Constantine and his son have done? The temples are empty. The pagan priests are impoverished. But these are the religions and priests that built the Roman Empire. Can we restore them to glory? And so what he tries to do is change paganism. He's like, Christianity won because it's better organized. So let's organize paganism with an identical hierarchy that's modeled off the church. Bishops, priests, you know, and so forth. Metropolitan bishops and then patriarchs and all that. Let's have this big hierarchy. I'll be the head of the pagan religion, just like, you know, Constantine thought he was the head of the church. And he's trying to restore it through this. But here's the problem. The damage had been done. Even though he's making it hard on Christianity at this time, as pagan rituals start to reemerge all over the empire, the subjects who were doing them mocked them. They didn't take it serious. By this point, they're thinking, yeah, you know, now that we've had time to think about it and we've seen a more sophisticated religion in Christianity, paganism does seem kind of dumb. So they were making fun of it. And this made him mad. So he took a more hostile approach to the church. He fired all Christians from the government. They were fired from the professions. They couldn't teach school anymore because he didn't want them teaching the classic literature. He then started writing polemics against them. Most famous one was called Against the Galileans. Galilean was the title he used for Christians. So he called them Galileans because Jesus did his ministry in Galilee. And yeah, he was very insulting of Christians and what we believe. And, you know, he knew the Bible better than a lot of the polemicists of the earlier time, because remember, he was raised Christian, so he could quote it well, and then he could mock it. And then his final thing he wanted to do, he's like, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to rebuild the temple, a Jewish temple in Jerusalem, because the Christians at that time were saying that the temple being destroyed was the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. If it's rebuilt, then the prophecy is not fulfilled. Christianity is proved false. And I will say, if he would have succeeded, that was pretty dumb, because the temple was still destroyed. And a lot of Christians believe another temple is going to be rebuilt. And even back then, some Christians believed that. And so, so really, this wasn't the own that he thought it was going to be. But either way, he didn't get to finish this because he gets killed. He was only emperor for 2 years. In the year 363, he goes to war with the Persians. He gets killed in battle, and there ends the two-year attempt of Julian the Apostate to make Rome pagan again. So would that be make Rome pagan again? Merapa instead of MAGA, right? Merapa. And so Christian tradition, and there's no way of proving this one way or another, but Christian tradition says his last words were, "Thou hast conquered, O Galilean," meaning Jesus, you beat me, you know, I raged against you for nothing. Now, there's no way to know. Could that be just Christians putting that in his mouth after the fact? Probably, right? So anyhow, Julian was the last Roman emperor to not profess the Christian faith. Under his successors, it becomes way more dominant. By the year 380, Emperor Theodosius I, and he's going to rule the whole of the empire from 379 to 395, he passes some anti-pagan edicts, and he also officially made Christianity the official religion of the empire. This is the empire. This is Rome's religion. It's Christianity. There was only one non-Christian group that the law tolerated at this point, and that was Jews. And so once this is established, okay, Christianity is now the official religion. Rome is a Christian empire, and you have a marriage of church and state. And so then the last thing we have to talk about is what this looks like. The relationship between church and state, the relationship between church and state would shift during his reign. And so in the West, you're going to have a move away from Caesaropapism or papism. But the argument against it even goes back to the time of Constantius. And so I'll explain that really quickly. When Constantius was emperor, as I mentioned, he embraced Arianism and said, this is what we're going with. I'm going to persecute Trinitarians. Athanasius declared him to be an antichrist and argued that, listen, emperors have no authority in church matters. I don't care if the emperor's an Arian. He does not get to tell us what we're supposed to believe. Well, obviously, Constantius disagreed with that and exiled Athanasius. Another instance where Constantius will be defied is he orders Bishop Hosius of Cordova, who was one of his father's advisors, but he orders him to accept Arians at the Lord's table in the year 355. And the bishop said no. And he quoted to him Matthew chapter 22, verse 21, where Jesus says, give to Caesar the things appointed to Caesar, give to God the things appointed to God. And he made an argument that Baptists would dance over. You know, you think Baptists were the first to say this. We weren't. He said, listen, Romans 13 gives earthly government power to the state and never to the church. He says, but the scripture gives ecclesial, spiritual power to the church and never to the state. And these cannot bleed over. Even if you have a Christian agent of the state, he can't use the power of the state to affect ecclesial matters any more than somebody in the church should use ecclesial power to affect state matters. And as Baptists, we'd all say, amen, that's perfect. And so that was the argument that he made. And it becomes widespread in the western half of the empire, not the eastern. The eastern accepted the Caesaropapism, but not the west. The west liked this argument. And so this position gets tested in a very dramatic way by the Bishop of Milan, a man you may have heard of, a man named Bishop Ambrose. And so, of course, his life dates are 339 to 397. So a little bit about Ambrose. We're getting close to being done. And so Ambrose, at first, he wasn't even trying to be a bishop. He was a governor. He was a governor in Milan, which is a very important city in Italy, second most important besides Rome. And he's just a provincial governor, not a bishop. The bishop was actually an Arian. Now, Ambrose was not, but he's like, hey, that's the church. I'm a governor. I got nothing to do with that. But when the bishop of Milan, Auxentius, who was an Arian, when he died in 374, and there was now going to be elections for a new bishop, there was almost going to be fighting and bloodshed in the street. The people were demanding that we have a Trinitarian, not an Arian, be a bishop in this very important church. Ambrose pretty much says, look, you're all going to get along. I'm the governor here. You're not going to be fighting. You're not going to be spilling blood in the street. You got me? And then all of a sudden, a little kid is like, Ambrose for bishop. I'm pretty sure that's what he sounded like. And then everybody's like, who said that? That's a good idea. And then everybody started chanting Ambrose for bishop. And then they had a vote right there on the spot and elected him as bishop. Now, this didn't make any sense. He wasn't baptized. He wasn't an ordained priest. First, you'd have to go through the catechism process. Then you'd have to be baptized. Then some bishop would have to ordain you as a priest or a presbyter. You'd have to serve for some time. And then maybe you become a bishop. He got to skip all that. Now, at first, he's like, no, I do not want this. He actually ran away and tried to escape the call, but I can't remember what I read. There was something that just made him reluctantly accept. And so he did and became the only bishop I know of that was not trained like all the rest were, and yet he becomes the most famous one of his time. In fact, Ambrose was considered the best preacher of the Western Empire. Augustine was his student. In fact, Augustine became a Christian because of Ambrose. Augustine hated Christianity. And then eventually he converted to Neoplatonism. And then he was in Milan. He's like, I'm going to hear this Ambrose guy. And when he heard him, he's like, oh, man, this guy's going to get me. And he did. And in fact, Ambrose is the one who baptized Augustine. So Ambrose was a big shot. And again, it's so interesting given the fact that he was a politician that was made bishop in a very unusual way, and then ends up becoming one of the most talented ones ever. He wrote hymns that people still sing today, some very famous ones. And he's also famous for writing hymns. And you might say, didn't you just say that? Yes. But understand this. He wrote hymns. Before him, not hymns, but him, before Ambrose, English language here, before Ambrose, they only sung the Psalms. People didn't compose their unique Christian songs based on the Bible. They're like, no, we're only going to sing the Psalms. He started saying, no, we need to write our own songs in addition to the Psalms because we have these Arians out here teaching false doctrine. And one way we could teach our people against Arianism and teach them about the Trinity is through song. And so he's the first one that starts doing that. And now, guess what? Most of us sing hymns today, don't we? Or we sing songs that are composed by people who are using in the Bible and its themes to write these songs. So that was definitely a development. Now, the big church and state battle here, there's two battles. Theodosius, he was like Constantine, but he wasn't compromised like Constantine, but he was a strong-willed ruler. You don't cross this guy, okay? And he had like temper tantrum outbursts as well. And you could die if you were in the way of that. Now, sometimes he would catch his temper and calm down, but he did have a temper. So he's not the type of guy you want to mess with. But Ambrose wasn't scared of nobody. And so these guys become friends, but two times their relationship gets tested. And this was a showdown between church and state, which explains why the Western church's relationship to the state is almost the exact opposite of the Eastern church's. The first one was in 388. Christians and Callinicum were ordered by Theodosius to rebuild a synagogue. They were anti-Semites. They burned a synagogue down. And Theodosius is like, I know Christianity is the official religion, but that is not right. So you're going to take money from the coffers of the church and you're going to rebuild that synagogue. Well, Ambrose is like, no, can't do that. Whether it was right or wrong to burn that synagogue down, you cannot take church money consecrated and sanctified for God and use it to build a place for non-Christian worship. You'll have to find the money elsewhere. And then Theodosius is like, no, this is the right thing to do. And so then Ambrose said, well, then you can't have communion. And then Theodosius, the emperor, shows up to his church service and the dude preaches a sermon where the whole sermon is against the emperor as he's sitting in the front row. I'm like, this dude's got some guts. He's like, okay, I have a sermon for you guys. This guy right here, most powerful man in the world, he's wrong. He's so wrong, I'm not going to let him take communion. Now, let me tell you why he's wrong. And then the whole sermon was about that. And Theodosius gave in. He's like, all right. I want to have communion. You know, fine. We're not going to use church money here to rebuild that synagogue. Now, an even bigger challenge came 2 years later. In the year 390, there was a very violent riot in the city of Thessalonica, and they murdered the governor there, the rioters did, and he was a governor that a lot of people loved. Good guy, right? And when Theodosius heard, like, there was a riot in my empire, and they killed one of my governors, all right, send the Thessalonian armies there, wipe these guys out. He was so mad. Remember, he gave himself over to tempers a lot. But after he realized, wait a minute, if they follow these orders, they're going to kill everybody in the city. I think I may have spoken rashly. So he gives a second order. He's like, call them off. I don't want them to do it. But that second order didn't get to the front line until it was too late. They already killed 7,000 people of the city. And again, they wanted to kill the 7,000. The soldiers did because they loved that governor as well. They're like, sweet vengeance here, right? And so Theodosius, he felt bad, you know, and he tried to prevent that, but he was a little too late. And so Ambrose is like, this is an outrage. He just excommunicated the emperor on the spot. He's like, you're excommunicated. You can't come here. You can't take the Lord's Supper, which again, gutsy move. And so then Theodosius shows up to church as if nothing happened, like, yeah, he doesn't mean it. And then Ambrose is like, no, you cannot be here. You must repent. And the emperor's like, I did repent. I'm sorry for it. I even called back the order. Ambrose is like, that's not enough. This was a public sin. There has to be public repentance. And the public repentance is going to be public penance. Now, I don't think Ambrose was right here. I think, biblically speaking, Theodosius did feel bad. What more was he supposed to do? But Ambrose wanted something just bigger than that. And so pretty much the emperor's like, fine, what do you want me to do? He's like, you are banned from the church for 8 months. You cannot take communion. You have to go through the whole city, you know, with dust and ashes on, showing everybody that you're torn up over this. And then 8 months, you do without church, you do without communion. And then when you come back, your first day back, you're going to kneel before God and confess your sin to the whole church. Now, again, a guy like Theodosius had a temperament similar to Constantine, and yet he's like, fine, I'll do it. He believed in God that much, and he believed that Ambrose as bishop had this kind of authority. And so he's like, fine, this I as emperor cannot rule the church, but the church can dictate who gets to take communion. And if you're saying biblically, I'm in such sin that this is what I have to do to be right with God, fine. And he did. And of course, Ambrose wrote a very friendly letter to the emperor. They were still friends during all this time, but he justified his actions and behavior to the emperor by citing Nathan and David. Like, David as a king did wrong. And David had the authority, but Nathan was still able to show up and you know, correct him and hold him accountable. And Theodosius agreed, and so he gave in. He complied. And that's fascinating, and that's why the Western church is going to be a little different, not a little, a lot different, very different from the Eastern church. So let me conclude, and then I'll take some questions. and we could get out of here. The 4th century began with Diocletian, the largest persecution of church in history, and then it ended with Christianity as the official religion of the empire. Very interesting how it starts and how it ends. Okay, a lot happens in that 100 years. The relationship between church and state became increasingly complex, and I hope that you saw that. In the East, it's going to be Constantine's Caesaropapism, and you still see that in Russia today, which Russian Orthodoxy comes from Eastern Orthodoxy. And we'll talk about that, I think, later in this course. If not this one, it'll definitely be talked about in church history too. In the West, Ambrose's separation of church and state prevailed. That, hey, the church deals with the church, state deals with the state matters. But look, his victories over Theodosius is eventually going to give way to theocracy in the West. It just is. Eventually, you're going to end up with the situation where the popes will use their ability to excommunicate rulers. They're going to use that to control those rulers. And eventually, the popes are going to be the ones who coronate kings, especially once they coronate Charlemagne in the year 800. So what's going to happen is the separation of church and state in the West turns into something where the church now has authority over the state in certain matters. So in the East, the state has authority over the church. In the West, eventually the church will get authority over the state. And again, that's going to be medieval Christianity. That's going to be Christianity under the popes. And eventually we'll talk about how you end up with popes. But the fact is, just to kind of give you a little forward view of it, the events of the 4th century paved the way for the development of the papacy. The rise of monasticism will play a big role, so we got to talk about that still. The government abandoning the West in favor of the East, meaning building Constantinople, that had consequences. The Western Empire fell. When the political empire of the West fell, guess what was still left? The church. The church was left, and who was the highest ranking person of the church in the West? The Bishop of Rome, okay? And so because of that, they're going to be able to reforge the West into Middle Ages Europe, okay? And that's why the Pope's going to be at the top of that society rather than some emperor, okay? And the ecumenical councils also, we haven't talked about those, Nicaea, Constantinople, and Chalcedon, but they're also going to enhance the Bishop of Rome's prestige because in every single one of these debates, the whatever the Bishop of Rome argued happened to be the right argument. And so they were later able to say, look, not only are we the ones descended from Peter, which they're not, but they're going to say that. They're going to be like, but in addition to that, notice there's only one city whose bishop has been right on every single controversy in church history, Bishop of Rome. And so those are going to be arguments that then pave the way, and they all come out of the 4th century. And eventually you're going to end up with popes.